Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show today, it is compost time. International Compost Awareness Week is just around the corner, kids. Have you gotten a card for your black gold yet? We're going to help raise that awareness by talking about the compost test results you may be able to view and about a five-step test you can do at home that'll probably tell you everything you need to know about compost you're thinking of using in your garden. But for now, it's a lot of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Susie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hello, Susie. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yourself?
I am just ducky. Where is Susie very well?
We're in Banning, California, about 4.5 miles away up into the mountains. Very nice here.
Okay, so what part of California?
Well, southern.
Really?
Yes, but we're about like 3,800 feet elevation. I mean, a lot of this area is pretty warm, but we get real cold snow in the wintertime, and we just barely hit 100 maybe on a few days in the summer.
Oh, man, there's nothing good about hitting 100, though. That's pretty good.
Yeah. No, there's not.
I know. As you move towards the ocean, it can get really brutal in, like, L.A. in July.
Yeah. Real bad.
Okay, so you're up in the mountains.
Well, halfway up, yes.
In a very unusual and picturesque part of California.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And where we are, we're very secluded, so it's even better.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like you'd be up far north in Eureka or something for that climate.
Yeah, you get the feeling of that.
Okay, right? Good. It's so what awesome. Can we do for Susie in mountainous Southern California?
We have a miniature mule and a pony and a little miniature horse. We collect their manure, and we were putting them in piles. But to do that, you have to scoop it, put it in a pile, then you got to scoop from the pile, and we have an acre, so... And it's difficult when you have a bad back. So what right. I thought up this idea, hey, we buy a manure in bags, so why not just take the manure and put it in bags right away and let it compost in there and poke some holes in the bottom so the worms can get in. But we use those big, black, thick contractor bags. The help has to shovel it into a wheelbarrow and take it up to wherever they're going. But if they can get a dolly underneath the bag of manure and just wheel it up there and dump it out, I could spread it around.
Okay, so let me go over the basics. You're talking horse manure. Horse manure is very hot in nitrogen. Manure is basically composted out in the open. The bigger a pile you can make and the hotter it is, the faster it'll compost down. And you don't want to use any kind of horse manure until it's fully composted, which means there's no smell, there's no heat left. And then you don't want to use horse manure on fruiting crops. You don't want to use it on...
Oh.
Yeah. Horse manure is almost all nitrogen. It has no other nutrients in it. Now, it's a great fertilizer for growing sweet corn, potatoes, lettuces, for spreading on lawns. It will grow big plants with few flowers and few fruits.
Trees as well.
Oh, my goodness.
Like apple trees, cherry trees, all that.
That would be the worst.
Okay. What about sheep and chicken?
Chicken manure is even hotter. So that's more nitrogen. That goes in the other direction. But I believe sheep manure might be close to perfect. And if I remember correctly, I don't even think you have to compost sheep manure. Doesn't that
Somebody
come out?
Told me that, but I didn't trust them.
Doesn't that come out in like pellets?
Yes.
Yes.
Little tiny little like peas, little larger than peas.
And they have a very different digestive system than horses, so I don't think their manure is weedy. So I think as you collect the sheep manure, you could spread it underneath your fruit trees.
Oh, very good.
The thing with fruit trees, they don't need a lot of nutrients. If you overfeed them, especially with nitrogen, especially with horse or poultry manure, you'll create all kinds of problems. But even though you live in a relatively pest-free climate, for these fruits, and it sounds like you have enough chilling hours. The thing with fruit trees is it's still essential to prune them every year and to thin the fruits.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Don't over-fertilize those fruit trees. You know, just be. It sounds like you have a lot of animals around, which is nice, but that doesn't mean that your plants need a lot of manure.
Okay, got it.
Just because you have a lot of something doesn't mean it's a good idea to use it all.
Okay, may I ask you, please, how long would you suggest to be composting the horse and the chicken?
That is so simple. That is so easy. Until it no longer feels hot or smells bad.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right, Suze?
Easy to understand. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your help.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Mark, how are you, sir?
Good. I'm out here in the beautiful city of Seattle right now, but I live in Appleton, Wisconsin, and I've got a vole problem, and I've heard a couple good ideas and bits of information from the last couple of shows that you've got, but some of your stuff talks about trying to get the voles to go to your neighbor's house, and I've got one or two neighbors that I don't want them to go to, and I got another neighbor I probably wouldn't mind them going to. But anyhow, I'm looking for a way to get rid of them.
Now you make me wonder whether you have moles, M-O-L-E-S, or voles, V-O-L-E-S.
Just from listening to your program on what they do on top of the soil and stuff, I think I got voles. But
okay, let me explain the difference. Moles,
okay,
M-O-L-E-S, live entirely underground. They make raised tunnels everywhere. They may have entrance and exit holes where they kick up some dirt and make mounds. They do not eat any plant material. They exist entirely carnivorously. They eat beetle grubs and earthworms and cicada larvae underground. You rarely see a mole above ground. And when you do, they're really weird looking. They're little blind creatures. Voles, V-O-L-E-S, are little shrew-like, mouse-like creatures that live like almost in between the surface of the soil and just below. In a lawn, for instance, they will make trails of areas they will go through very often just by matting the grass down with their little feet. Voles also go underground, and they are total vegetarians. They eat spring bulbs. They eat the roots of plants like hostas. So which do you have?
I have the voles. I've got the trails. When the snow melts, we got all the trails in the grass. And
okay,
all that.
Good.
And there are some poles into the other areas, but I'm almost positive I got voles. I just want to get rid of them because they're all over the place.
Yes. Well, they do have the fastest metabolism of the small mammals in North America, and they do breed more vigorously than any other mammal of any size in North America. There can be hundreds at the end of the season after starting out with a single mated pair. Do you have wood mulch or any heavy mulch?
Yes, I got wood mulch.
Okay, so that's where they're living. The mulch is totally protecting them from predators. So one of the first answers is get rid of that wood mulch. I mean, it's really no good for your landscape. It's no good for your home or car, or even for you.
Okay.
But it provides great protection for them. Otherwise, they are prey to cats and owls and hawks. The first line of defense after getting rid of the mulches is to spray with a concentrated castor oil product. These are available in both liquid and solid form. They'll be labeled as mole and vole repellents. And you want to look that the active ingredient is castor oil, and you want to look for the one with the highest concentration. And spread that around heavily, whether you put down little pellets, little grains, or whether you mix up a solution and spray it around. But put it down heavily in the spring. It will impart a bad smell underground to your soil that makes voles want to move away. That was the sending them to your neighbors thing.
Right.
So if you want, you can start at one end of the property and sweep them towards the neighbor you think could use this kind of excitement
that's
in their life. And I would repeat it again. If you have a lot of them, I would repeat it again a month later. If that's not enough, then you're probably going to have to go to some form of a mouse trap. Moles, again, will only eat meat, but voles will eat any vegetable material. And so they are just as attracted to peanut butter as mice are. And if you want to use regular old snap traps outside, what you do is you put a couple of them baited with peanut butter under a shoebox or a shipping carton, and then cut little holes in the bottom on the side, because you don't want birds coming down and trying to get at the peanut butter. So you put a rock on top of that, you make a little enclosed trap, and you'll catch a lot of voles that way. So the first thing I would do is try to repel them, and if not, try to trap them. But honestly, man, if you get rid of that wood mulch, I think they'll disappear, and I think you'll notice more raptors in your neighborhood.
Gotcha. Okay, very cool. Thanks, Mike.
All right, thank you, Mark. Good luck, sir.
You bet. Yeah, bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Easttown Library in Berwyn, PA on Wednesday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. and at the Green Garden Fair in Cherry Hill, New Jersey on Saturday, May 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the details on sniffing your black gold and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, do you have a source of free compost nearby? Are you thinking of having a big load of compost delivered, but you wonder what's in it? Well, there may be a soil lab test report on that compost. You should certainly ask about it. But those things are really hard to read. We'll talk about some of the issues when we also reveal five simple tests you can do on your own that should be very reassuring. Up until then, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, it's a pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you here, Andrew. Where are you?
I'm in Queen Village, Philadelphia.
Queen Village is a great little community just below South Street, the gateway to South Philadelphia, very close to the Delaware River, and with great views. Maybe Buena Vista is a part of Queen Village.
Yeah, that's right. We're right next to Bella Vista, and as you say, it's a fantastic neighborhood to live in, except for this one thing, which is a brutal mosquito problem that we have pretty much in the whole neighborhood, but especially in our community garden.
Now, I don't know if you heard the show we did about a month back with Dr. Dina Fonseca from Rutgers University. It was an entire show on mosquito control. So I urge you to go back and listen to that one, even if you did hear it the first time. There's almost too much information to absorb. But one thing she talked about was she put this new mosquito, the quote, the Asian tiger mosquito, the one we've been battling for like the last decade, the day flying mosquito. She defined that mosquito in a very different way to me. To her, it wasn't the day flying or other aspects. The researchers, they call it the urban mosquito because it thrives in these urban areas where kind of our old school mosquitoes don't do as well because there aren't these big natural areas for them to breed in. But these disease-carrying, day-flying, quote, urban mosquitoes, they thrive in a place like Center City, Philadelphia, or South Philadelphia, or the little neighborhoods around it. So I urge you to go back and listen very carefully and read the question of the week we did that week about how they lay their eggs, because you can't get rid of their eggs by just emptying standing water around the garden or the neighborhood. They're much trickier than that. Now, I'll also tell you one very exciting thing Dr. Fonseca talked about. You're familiar with BTI, right? The natural mosquito larvicide, the little dunks and granules you put in standing water to prevent mosquito breeding?
I am, yes. And we do use them to a certain extent in some water barrels we have around the site.
Good, because just across the river, I believe, in Camden, they did a program where they took mosquito spray trucks that would normally spray chemicals, and they sprayed BTI instead. And the results were remarkable. They got a knockdown of the mosquito population that was well above 90%. So that's something that you need to talk to the people at Rutgers. You need to get the city involved in. I'll tell you about two other things that I think are really exciting. My listeners in the D.C. area have told me about a company out there, I believe it's called Mosquito Joe, who got their start just going around spraying homes with long-term pesticides to keep mosquitoes down in the outdoors. And just this year or the previous year, they started offering a botanical alternative, which is a mixture of natural essential oils that they spray instead, that is a variation on the old trick of spraying garlic oil. Garlic oil was the original backyard mosquito spray that was non-toxic. Well, they think, and I can't remember the botanicals, rosemary is one of them. There's like three or four botanicals mixed into this spray. And they say they have to come out and spray it more often, like every month instead of 6 weeks. But it's highly effective. And it might be something, first of all, you could certainly get the community garden to pitch in and get the garden sprayed with like oil of rosemary and cedar and natural things like that. But you might be able to mount a neighborhood campaign as well. The final thing, and this literally just came in over the transom. This was an email I got literally like 10 days ago from a guy who had been listening to the mosquito show, and he made a natural mosquito repellent. He apparently has a company that packages up a lot of botanical things, and he used essentially all of the great research. Dr. Fonseca and I talked about how lemon eucalyptus was probably right now the best available natural mosquito repellent. It's been shown to be as effective as DEET. It's widely available. But there's also great promising research I've been talking about for years that showed catnip to perhaps have more potential as a natural mosquito repellent, and several other herbs as well. Well, this guy, and the name of his little company is, and I don't know how little or big it is, the packaging was pretty nice, Half Moon Valley Herbals. And he sent me a couple of samples, and the ingredients are perfect. The ingredients are all of these things that have scored really high in research studies, but they're all plant-based. He's got lemon eucalyptus in there. He's got catnip. He's got, you know, all of these plants that have shown to be highly effective in natural mosquito prevention. So this is something you could use on yourself if you're tired of giving blood, not to the Red Cross.
Wow, that's fantastic. The mosquitoes at the garden are certainly much worse at dusk and dawn. Does that imply that they're not the urban mosquitoes, or are those guys also worse?
These mosquitoes, the ones you're describing, that's BTI traps. That's leave out tons of water everywhere and get the donuts and get the briquettes and make sure it always has BTI in it. And if there's any way you can move towards hiring somebody to do a BTI spraying, the knockdown is just amazing.
Yeah, I think we can do all those things.
Then, you know, make it a neighborhood effort and move towards getting the city to be interested in BTI. Look at it big picture.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thanks, Mike. I am going to definitely do that.
All right. Good luck, Andrew.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm great. I'm calling from Morgantown, West Virginia.
Okay. And what can we do for Chris in Morgantown?
Well, now I have a question. I was listening to your show last week about asparagus, and the person had called and wanted to know if burning the asparagus would eventually kill the larvae and the asparagus beetle. And from my experience of growing asparagus for 25 to 30 years, it has no effect.
So this was a call, a guy who had asparagus beetle problem. I mean, I do not grow asparagus personally because too many of my raised beds are already taken up by what people would consider perennial crops like garlic. I just don't have the room. But my understanding is the two enemies of asparagus growers are the asparagus beetle and weeds.
Yes. If you want to get rid of your asparagus, just let the weeds grow up or just keep mowing it down and try growing some grass seed in the area. And that's what we did with our first bed after around 20 years, 25 years. It was getting too root bound. And before we destroyed that bed, we set up a new bed so we wouldn't lose our asparagus crop every year.
Oh, okay. Did you move crowns or did you buy new ones?
We did move a couple, but asparagus root system is like bound spaghetti. you need a backhoe to get it, but it will die very quickly with just mowing off the spears and the fronds and just letting the weeds or reseeding it with grass.
So I would hope that somehow the lone wild asparagus spear would come up to say hello every once in a while.
It does. It comes up in flower beds and pine trees and that sort. But we did buy two-year roots because if you grow it from seed, you have to wait till the third year to cut it. And then you only cut it for like 2 years. And then after the third year, you can cut it for up to 6 to 8 weeks before it grows out. And then you can even still get a few spears occasionally after that. And plus you want male plants. You don't want females because they have the berries or the seeds. They drop, and then your beds get really crowded. And as they get more crowded, then your crop isn't as heavy or the spears are thinner.
I can remember back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, the advice was always to start with established crowns. And back then, these all male plants were kind of new. And as you say, they solved the problem of the seed production and overcrowding.
Yeah.
What I know about asparagus is to tell people the first couple of years, harvest very gently, if at all. And then in years after that, stop harvesting when the new spears that come up in the spring are no bigger than a pencil. And then let some of those spears develop fronds to absorb solar energy to fuel the growth of the roots. And this guy was burning his fronds in the hopes of destroying the overwintering asparagus beetles. But you say that doesn't work.
No. What really brings out the asparagus beetle is hot weather. So if you have a cool spring, say it's in the 60s, low 70s, and it stays that way till mid-June for us,
mm-hmm.
if we can keep that cooler weather, the asparagus beetle is not a problem. But we do have sometimes 80-degree weather in May, and it's the hot weather brings them out. So we burn every spring, and it has not had any effect on the beetle. It's the hot weather.
You're just saying you've just been at the mercy of the weather. In a cool year, you do great. In a hot year, you got the beetles.
the beetles, you can see their eggs because they look like little cactus vines on the spears. So I usually just go out there and basically massage or rub the eggs off. And the beetles, I'll just go out there with and just squish them. And a lot of times they'll jump off and they'll find any crack in the ground to hide in. But usually don't spray too much unless they're really heavy after the fronds are out and they're just devouring the fronds. But otherwise, we do mostly organic, just picking the beetles off. In our area, at least, what I have found from growing it for 30 years, it's weather-related.
And you know there is a new BT out there that's effective against a wide range of beetles. I don't know if it's indicated for the asparagus beetle, but there might be an organic control for them now.
Well, I'll check that out. But I will spray if it's a really heavy infestation, but usually we just hope for a mild winter and at least till mid-June, and then after that they're not a problem. You have a few occasional beetles, but they have a breeding time, and usually by mid-June, that's pretty much over with.
Okay. All right. So, well, here's one vote that burning won't stop them from Chris in West Virginia.
They have not helped us at all.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. You have a good season.
Thank you. I enjoy your show.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. What's happening today?
Everything. You're happening, Mike.
I hear you.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Washington, New Jersey.
And what part of Jersey is that?
Off of Route 57, between Phillipsburg and Hackettstown.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Jersey Mike?
Hey, I have a problem. I got a couple of nice trees. I got like 2 acres on my property.
Mm-hmm.
And the termites are going crazy, especially on one tree in front of my house. They started eating like inside the bark, and the bark is starting to come apart. And this tree is like at least 100 feet long, really, really huge.
Okay, that's...
And
now, wait a minute, Mike. Has the tree, did it leaf out last year?
Yeah, it's leafing out every year. But now I looked at one of the arms from the tree, and I seen it that it's eating it up.
I
don't know if it,
and what makes you think it's termites? Because termites typically only are attracted to dead wood or cellulose, things like cardboard.
I have no idea. That's the only thing that I figured I would eat. I have a tree that comes out, and it has like 6 or 7 arms, and it started eating the arms little by little. I don't know what kind of a bug it is. I see some little tiny holes on the wood.
But you haven't seen any insects?
No.
And you say you're seeing little holes, but the trees are leafing out all right?
Yeah, the trees are leafing out okay.
Well, and you don't know what kind of trees they are?
No, I think regular trees. I got some black oak. They're not touching them.
Mm-hmm.
But just regular trees with heavy-duty bark. It looks like really tough bark from those old trees that are over 100 years old. I looked up a high, like about 20 or 30 feet, and it has one arm from the tree that's being eaten away.
Now, you say it's being eaten away. What do you mean? You mean it's a dead limb up there?
Yeah, there's a dead limb. It looks like something is eating it away, and it's just pulverizing it.
Yeah, no, what happens in older trees when a limb dies is it just rots. You know, every time it rains, it gets wet. And then if that limb is really dead, carpenter ants or other insects may work away at it. And it's a danger. It is a danger to people walking underneath. So if you want to nip this problem in the bud, then you would want to call a certified arborist to come out and take a look at the trees and maybe take that dead limb off or maybe do a bigger pruning job over the winter.
Yeah, definitely.
But if let's say 98% of the tree is healthy, then what you're experiencing is entirely normal. Now, if large parts of the bark fall off, then you want to call your county extension agent and ask them to help you identify the tree by the leaves. Send them pictures of an individual leaf, and
right.
and maybe they can come out and take a look. But an arborist could also come out and take a look. But again, if the canopy is filling out really nicely, it's not an issue.
Okay.
And you don't have termites.
Right.
Okay?
All right, Mike. I listen to your show every Saturday and Sunday.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that.
You are the man.
You the man. All right. Take care,
all right,
Mike.
Bro. God bless, brother.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will present a Titanic Talk on Tomatoes on Saturday, May 13th, during the big annual plant sale at the Seed Farm in Emmaus, PA, in the Lehigh Valley. Then I'll return to the Allentown Library for an appearance on Wednesday, May 24th at 7 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the details on sniffing your black gold and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. How to read a soil test lab report on municipal and otherwise purchased compost, or how to test it yourself at home and be very confident that the results will tell you whether you want to use it or not. Will reveal all that fascinating information after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm well today. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thank you. Where is Elizabeth well?
I am in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
The Christmas city.
You got it.
What can we do for Elizabeth in Bethlehem?
Well, I guess the focus of the call would be to discover how to do a raised bed, but I would need to import soil. I'm unable to use the soil that I've always used here in my plot. I had the soil tested and it tested at all in the optimum range at Penn State. And then additionally to that, I had a lead abatement performed on the house. And so I thought, I better check the soil for heavy metals. And I had it tested for lead. And the garden area tested 207.94 milligrams per kilogram. So it's low, but it's recommended not to grow leafy greens and not even to let, the dust come up for the kids. So
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I would consider that kind of a high number. I don't have my stats in front of me or anything like that. But yeah, people misunderstand. Any garden near an older home, and older, I mean, only going back to like the 60s or 70s. Yours goes back, for all I know, your home goes back to the 1700s.
It was in the 1800s. So.
Yeah. A lot of lead paint was used. The lead got there from leaded gasoline in the air, and lead is like plutonium. Lead is forever. I mean, it's an element. It doesn't go away. And people think the danger is they're eating the lead in their vegetables. So they read all these studies about which vegetables take up lead and which don't. And as you learned, the real danger is just working the soil, is getting the lead into the air and inhaling it. And it's, of course, very dangerous for children. So I think you're doing the right thing. If you can get into a program, if your lead levels are high enough that you qualify, there may be a state program that would take some of your soil away. So you might want to check into that. And I would work with the same soil lab that, told you about the lead levels, see if there's any, as you said, lead abatement programs. They may be available for outdoors as well as in. Because really, if you were in a certain situation, a lot of times you simply have to have the soil trucked away to a hazardous disposal site and replaced. But if you have a nice level ground and you're ready to start doing raised beds, the advice is just cover what you have. Don't till it up. Don't disturb it or anything like that. Cover everything you have out there with like a single layer of cardboard. And then have somebody build you, or you build, raised bed frames that are no wider than 4 feet. They can be as long as you want. And you drop those into place right on top of the cardboard, make them a good foot high, and then make sure you have 2-foot-wide walking lanes in between them. The reason the beds are no wider than 4 feet is you're going to fill them with loose, rich, wonderful soil, and you never want to step in that soil. Soil compaction is deadly to plants. So raised beds, you're actually going to get much better results. So I would fill the actual raised beds, find a good local source of high-quality compost and topsoil. You want the topsoil to be rich, black, and screened, and you want the compost to be yard waste compost, not composted manure, and maybe mix in some perlite, which is a natural mined material to lighten up the beds. Fill inside the frames with that, but then this is the perfect situation where you can use wood chips to keep weeds down in the lanes in between the raised beds. If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, click on Garden Answers A to Z, go to Raised Beds, R for Raised Beds, and then under C for compost, under bulk compost, I describe two simple little tests you can do to make sure the compost is good quality and safe.
Okay.
All right?
Sounds good, Mike. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Elizabeth.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I am just ducky, thank you. Where is Mary Terrific?
In Telford, Pennsylvania.
Okay, not far outside of Philadelphia.
No, not at all.
All right, what can we do for Mary in Telford?
Well, my husband and I have been looking to identify a tree that will give us a little bit of privacy from a neighbor. And we have identified a tree, and I wanted to ask your opinion of what you thought of this.
What's your tree?
And it is a serviceberry.
Oh.
And it's a specific species of called Princess Diana. because what I've read is that particular species doesn't mind to have moist feet, and wanted to know what you thought about that.
Okay, so you got an area of poor drainage.
Mm-hmm.
That's always going to be a tricky situation. Now, serviceberry, what an excellent choice. That's a native tree, produces edible fruits that we can enjoy, fruits that wildlife can enjoy. I don't know anything about its tolerance for wet feet. I'm kind of skeptical that a specific variety would have that capability as opposed to others. But if you've done the research, what does it say about its drainage requirements in general?
And that's what's a little bit troubling. In our research, we found that one website might say it likes a drier type soil. Another will say it can tolerate moist. It's not real, real wet, but it's a little bit damp over in the area that we're considering.
So we're not talking about standing water. We're not talking about a place where the gutters drain.
Oh, no, not at all. No.
Well, you know, the serviceberry is a remarkable tree. We don't talk about it very much. It's underutilized in the landscape, but I've never heard of anyone who planted it who regretted it. The berries are very tasty, and the trees grow to a good size, but they don't get unmanageable. And as they mature, they put on a good amount of fruit, enough for you to share with the birds. So if there's no standing, you know, I'll tell you what, I don't know that we've ever talked about this. What you do, go out to the area where you're hoping to plant this tree and take a couple shovelfuls of dirt out of the ground and then get a bucket of water and pour the bucket of water into the holes and then mark how long it takes the water to leave the hole. And if the water's still there a day later, the drainage is probably not going to be good enough. But if the water is gone in an hour or two, that should be fine. But I think you may have already selected the perfect tree for the situation. Were you thinking about installing it in the spring or the fall?
Well, and that's the other thing. I know sometimes the fall is a better time to plant, but we were thinking of doing it in the spring.
Okay. Well, I would urge you that if you are going to do it in the spring, don't delay until it actually becomes summer. Summer planted trees are very hard to keep alive. But if you find the tree you want, and my advice to you is spend a little bit more, buy an older tree. Don't look for a deal here. Look for a good quality tree that's already a couple years old, has some good height. And then disregard any other tree planting advice you get from anybody else. You want to remove all the wrappings. You want to toss them away. You want to plant this thing as high as it was in the pot or however you have to plant it to keep the root flare above ground. And then refill the hole with the soil you took out. Then when you're done, and you have the tree planted high without any wrappings underground, then you can put a couple inches of compost around it as a mulch and let a hose drip there to give it its initial watering. The initial watering is very important. You want to let a hose drip at the base of that tree for a good 24 hours. I think you've made a great choice, Mayor.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your input, and I'm a longtime listener of your show and was so excited that I had a question to call in for.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mayor. And again, good luck this summer.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. You Bet Your Garden producer, Alexis Landis, will get us started with this week's question, which we're calling, is it good compost or bad compost?
Yeah, nice Glinda impersonation there. Ahem. Lucinda in the Germantown section of Philadelphia writes, I have been going to the recycling center in Fairmount Park and bringing home buckets of their free compost. But as I listen to you more carefully, I'm wondering if the compost is full of pesticides. An analysis from the soil lab at Penn State is posted at their website, but I don't know how to make sense of it. Can you help? I know I should make my own, and I'm working on getting a worm bin set up.
All right. First, nobody makes enough of their own compost. I have about 20 different systems going. A giant circle of metal fencing filled with shredded leaves, smaller circles of welded wire filled with shredded leaves mixed into coffee grounds, 4 black plastic composters with locking lids that are filled with shredded leaves that I mix my kitchen waste into, an indoor stackable worm bin that processes the rest of my kitchen waste, and last summer's tomato cages all filled with shredded leaves back in the fall. And I'll barely have enough for my own needs. In fact, I'll probably have to import some compost myself this spring for a special project I'm doing.
Can you get bulk compost locally? And how will you know if it's good enough?
I have 3 local sources. A nearby garden center, a big mulch dealer that sells supposedly premium compost, and my local municipal supply. I'm going to get a 5-gallon bucket of each of them and give them all the enhanced duck test.
Enhanced duck test?
Yeah, retired University of Maryland compost guru Dr. Frank Goen taught me the basic 3-step duck test years ago. Does it smell like rich black soil? Does it look like rich black soil? And does it feel like rich black soil when you pick it up and squeeze it?
And if all 3 answers are yes, it's a duck, aka good compost.
Exactly. And over the years, I added 2 other tests. One to detect the persistent lawn grass herbicides that weren't around when I first spoke with Dr. Goen, and one I created to test for possible weed seeds. You fill 2 containers, regular plant pots that have good drainage, with the compost. In one, you plant a good amount of fresh seeds. Be sure to count them first. The other one you just leave naked. Then you water them both every day. If the naked one stays naked, it's not weedy. If the seedlings germinate well in the 80% range or higher, and the young plants look healthy and vigorous, herbicides are not an issue.
Should you use any special kinds of seeds?
I was told that pea and bean seeds are supposed to be the best indicators of herbicides, but the Penn State Soil Lab used the seeds of a classic cucumber variety named Market Moore 76. My advice is just to use the freshest seeds you have on hand.
So, our listeners' Philly Compost went through a professional germination test?
And scored a perfect 100. It sprouted just as many seeds, and the seedlings were just as vigorous as from seeds planted in the control of a bagged soil-free seed starting mix. And that's what Al Ratty of the U.S. Composting Council said was the most significant number on the 13-page report. The Philly Compost grew seedlings perfectly. And if seedlings grow perfectly, everything else is almost certainly going to grow well. Seedlings are the canary in the coal mine. And Al said that that 100% was really the only number he needed to see.
But did the rest of the report have anything of concern?
Oh, yeah. Things like soluble salts, fecal coliform, lead, mercury, zinc, all really scary words.
I'll say, I don't want any fecal coliform or lead in my garden.
Well, good luck to you, because they're in every gram of soil on the planet. Now, the Fairmount Park compost had 25 milligrams per kilogram of lead. The EPA limit is 300 milligrams. The fecal coliform registered 4.5 on a scale where 1,000 units are allowed by the EPA. So this compost could be a poopy 100 times worse and still be way on the side of the angels.
Wow, my head is spinning. And you had to ask for help? You wrote a best-selling book on compost. Your TED Talk on composting is approaching 500,000 views on YouTube.
And you know, the day I stop reaching out to experts for help with stuff like this is the day we need to close down this show. My relative inability to immediately interpret those test results showed me that civilians have almost no chance, and I reacted emotionally to line items like lead and arsenic. In reality, they were detected at levels the EPA and the Composting Council consider to be, quote, incredibly low. But they were just scary words and random numbers on a page without some kind of context.
So what's a poor gardener to do?
I say do the enhanced duck test. Don't even think about using compost that smells bad or looks bad or that grows weeds or distorted seedlings. All gardening is a crapshoot. There are no pristine areas left here on Krypton. And even reasonably good compost is still going to be 100 times better for your garden than chemical fertilizers. Well, that was hopefully some helpful information about compost now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with lots more specific information about soil lab test results and links to other great compost information, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to contaminate my compost if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please include your location in your email. And or visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about where you are, but where you will probably find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us about. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our intern is Eileen Bleeds Villanova Blue and White Kelly. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia and got her blue and white on at American U. Our editor, Al Banks, bleeds Nittany Lion Blue and White. Bringing up the Cherry and White Coalition are our webmaster, Rich Banowitz, our faithful internet companion, Sarah the She-Devil Kazar, and me, your wise old Al, Mike McGrath. And I'll walk over acres of diamonds to visit Annenberg Hall before I see you again next week. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.